to this edition of Scope It Out, the official podcast of the International Forum of Allergy and Rhinology. I'm your guest host for this episode, Dr. Doug Ray from Baltimore, Maryland, and today I'm speaking with Dr. Josh Levy. Josh is the clinical director at the NIDCD at the NIH, and he also recently joined our clinical practice, the Centers for Advanced ENT Care, as a rhinologist and a general otolaryngologist in the Feldman Division in Chevy Chase, Maryland. Today, we're going to be discussing his recent publication, Allergic Fungal Rhinosinusitis Diagnosis, Management, Associated Conditions, Pathophysiology, and Future Directions, a summary of a multidisciplinary workshop. Josh, thanks a lot for joining me.
Thank you so much, Doug. It's a true honor. I've had Scope It Out on my radar as one of the accolades I have wanted to achieve to be invited to speak for a long time now. And it's truly, I feel like a kid, very, very excited by the invitation. Thank you.
Well, you have so many great papers. I might have to get you again in another year or so because your contribution to IFAR has been fantastic. So I feel honored to have you here. Josh, just to get us started, I'm going to quote the intro because this is kind of a different paper. It's a great review, but it's really interesting the way that you all put this information together. So I wanted to sort of quote the intro to your paper and then have you talk a little bit about the process. So the quote I was going to read from the intro is that in December of 2023, a multidisciplinary group of rhinologists, otolaryngologists, pulmonologists, allergists, immunologists, scientists, and infectious disease experts met at the NIH to discuss unmet needs for the future of AFRS, which is allergic fungal rhinosinusitis research and care, including patient management, diagnostic criteria, severity, pathophysiology, and related conditions. So, Josh, talk a little bit about how this all came together and sort of how that process worked to put this paper together.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I joined the NIH just over 2 years ago now, and this idea of bringing together a broad group of physicians and researchers to discuss one challenging project, one challenging topic, was something that I had been working on before making the move from Emory. However, when I saw this opportunity to join the NIH, the literally first thing I thought was, no better place to hold this meeting. Let's bring everyone to the NIH. Let's use the resources that we can to really make this as impactful as possible. You know, the underlying why comes from the clinic and just the number of AFRS patients that I'd struggled with, number that did incredibly well, and my complete inability to project ahead of time who would be the one coming back and who wouldn't. So, you know, it's a different animal, AFRS. And the goal of reaching out to all of these different specialists is to learn what I, as a rhinologist and otolaryngologist, don't know. And truly, for me, I think we'll talk about it a little bit. Some of the most exciting parts of this conversation were from the infectious disease experts, different viewpoints, pulmonologists treating corollaries of AFRS in the lungs. It was just a great opportunity for me to learn. And the whole goal for the paper was to highlight some of those more salient points that we discussed, recommendations going forward, more research that's needed, and how ultimately we can leverage this to impact patient care.
So how many people did you have involved in this process of writing the paper and meeting and discussing all these topics?
Yeah, absolutely. So first and foremost, this was a team effort, and it required not only personal effort, but some of our leading societies, the American Rhinologic Society, the American Association for Otolaryngic Allergy. They both contributed money from their own coffers to support travel for our 20 or so participants from across North America, Canada, as well as the US. Beyond that, we had four leaders that I think you will recognize their names immediately. Amber Luong, Cecilia Damask, Lauren Rowland, and myself. Without all four of us, there's no way that this would have gotten off the ground and been successful. Particularly, I want to highlight Lauren Rowland in writing this manuscript and taking 2 full days of lectures and discussions and being able to filter that in a way that I every time I look at the paper as the senior author, I still learn more. And it's really a lot of fun.
That's really interesting. And it's amazing that you could pull together all these resources. So sort of let's dive in, Josh. And we all know that AFRS is a different animal, a different pathology from the Th2 mediated chronic sinusitis that we deal with, probably at least in my region, more frequently. So I'd love to just kind of go through the paper with you. And to start, it's very well organized. We'll talk a little bit about the clinical information or the clinical section that talks about the disease and how it presents. Josh, talk a little bit about the presentation in AFRS as it compares to the traditional chronic sinusitis with nasal polyps. How does it differ?
Yeah, you bet. So, you know, as I mentioned, these are the patients that I have truly struggled with, that I think the worst I had heard, and thankfully this was not one of my patients, but a young girl who was in her 20s and had had 12 sinus surgeries and just mowing the lawn. Polyps kept coming back and we kept doing the same thing. So in general, and I want to emphasize that in general, just because we don't have good nationwide or worldwide studies, but what we do have, mostly from the Southeast U.S., MUSC in particular has contributed a good bit for our understanding of the presentation. AFRS tends to affect younger patients. There's an association with environmental allergy. It's one of our diagnostic criteria, fungal allergies specifically. There's interestingly, and I want to talk about this later when we talk about the research, but there's a lower association of asthma in patients with AFRS versus other forms of nasal polyps or even CRS in general. It almost seems as if there's a protective effect, which only recently are we starting to be able to understand. Other findings, you know, this is a disease where CT scan, oftentimes you can make a call and be correct based on unique findings of that scan. There's bony sinus expansion, sometimes subtle, sometimes quite dramatic. It is not unusual in my prior practice in Atlanta to have referrals for concerns that these patients had intracranial tumors. It was just expansion of this terribly inflamed sinus, this disease. The presentation can be asymmetric. You know, it really is the exception to the rule that nasal polyps occur bilaterally. In AFRS, they certainly can present bilaterally, but interestingly, especially in younger children, we see it present unilaterally, and then years later, the contralateral sinus may become inflamed and affected, something that I still don't have a good understanding of why that happens. We also know that these patients smell very poorly. There seems to be quite a strong impact on olfaction, although that, again, has not been studied well. And these patients recur. You know, interestingly, as they age into 30s, 40s, in general, the disease tends to calm down. I'd like to counsel my patients that we can hope and expect that it will burn out with time. But until that happens, the ones that don't respond well to our standard treatments, they can have recurrences within months after appropriate sinus surgery.
That was something I found interesting in your paper is, let's talk about the next section in your paper, recurrence and severity. And what I learned as a surgeon was always that if you cleaned out all the fungal debris and got everything really opened up and you got rid of the presence of the fungus in these patients' sinuses, they were essentially cured. Like they would just normalize over time. So why do you think And I will say, as opposed to like TH2 mediated disease, where there's an underlying driving process that even if you do a good surgery, you're always fighting against that process, and it's innate to the patient. So yeah. Do you think the rates of recurrence are higher in this disease?
Yeah. So I think you're kind of hitting the mark on my thinking as to why they're so recurrent. And it does match with these high TH2 phenotypes of sinusitis. You know, AFRS is one of the poster children, along with AERD, for very high type 2 inflammatory signal. And I agree with you. I was trained, and I think about AFRS the same way surgically, in that you have to clear all the eosinophilic debris. And that's the nidus for the inflammation. And, you know, if you open up a sinus but leave a little bit of that debris there, I've seen patients recur within months following that surgery. I think the reason that we can't expect a cure by clearing all of the eosinophilic debris is because the underlying reaction to the fungal elements are still present. And even if we remove a lot of that nidus, fungus is everywhere. And the patient in the post-operative recovery room is going to be re-exposing to airborne fungal species. And I think it's, without controlling that underlying inflammatory state, it's a tall order.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And certainly I've had patients where I was very confident that I got all the gross fungal debris out, but yet after a year and a half, they recurred. So that's really interesting. So let's move on, just so we can sort of keep on the time. Talk a little bit about the diagnostic criteria, and specifically, because this is something we all learn in residency, what the diagnostic criteria are for AFRS. But what are the criteria that you think are sort of accurate in making the diagnosis, and which criteria have been out there for a while, which are less helpful in making the diagnosis?
You bet. So the primary criteria is the Benton-Kuhn, which interestingly was defined about 25 years ago. And based on Fred Kuhn's clinical practice, so one provider, the case series of 15 patients, you know, it's a very, very small sample. And I would argue not representative of the spectrum of allergic fungal disease. And speaking of, you know, the criteria that aren't as helpful, one of them is nasal polyps. And, you know, our goal is to rid these patients of their polyps, but they still have the allergic fungal disease. So when you're evaluating someone who's had surgery, say the disease is controlled, they no longer meet criteria, although we intuitively, we know they have that disease. So nasal polyps is one that, you know, can be helpful, but is not going to help you determine within the spectrum of polyp disease if they have AFRS or something else. Fungal hypersensitivity is a criteria which is challenging, although when you have a positive fungal test, it's obviously very helpful and, you know, helps to point you in the right direction. The reason that I say it's challenging is the number of antigens to fungal species way beyond tens of thousands of potential targets. So unlike, let's say you're evaluating someone for cat allergy, there's only one antigen. So you test for FLD1, you've got them covered. You can say they're allergic to a cat or not. But with fungus, you could test Aspergillus with 10 different antigens and still miss the one Aspergillus antigen that they're actually reacting to. So research that's ongoing, and I don't want to take Amber's thunder, Amber Luong is leading this, is looking at adding serum IgE, which we know to be tremendously high in patients with allergic fungal sinusitis. If you can either add that to fungal hypersensitivity, or in the case where you don't detect the specific antigen that the patient may be hypersensitive to, is there a cutoff where high IgE would then maintain your sensitivity to identify those patients? But definitely more to come there. I think imaging is incredibly helpful. As I mentioned, sinus expansion, you have mixed densities within the eosinophilic mucin from heavy metal deposits from the fungus. That can be quite characteristic and helpful. Eosinophilic mucin is another one of the diagnostic criteria. It is sensitive, but it's not specific. I'd love to show endoscopy, mostly to gross out the non-ENTs in the audience. But I say, look at this eosinophilic mucin, they have AERD. And then I talk about allergic fungal, and I show the same exact video, is they endoscopically may look completely alike. So the specificity isn't quite there with that one. And then the final is fungal culture or a fungal stain. I do not culture the secretions of these patients because I've learned over time that, and this is something that I picked up from Tim Smith, a positive fungal culture is more indicative of your lab's ability to grow fungus than it is identifying something in the patient's nose. And the reason for that is we all have fungus in our nasal airways. It's present all around us. It's a sign of healthy soil. So I like to use a fungal stain, which of course is something you can only get following a surgical procedure. And you often see a line of fungal elements along the nasal mucosa. It's non-invasive, but it's present and immediately adjacent to the areas of inflammation.
Thanks, Josh. That's super, super helpful in trying to understand it and what we should be focusing on and maybe what we shouldn't. And certainly we'll talk a little bit more later on about future studies, but the determining what the IgE levels could be to separate this out from other similar entities is certainly interesting. And we'll maybe touch on that again. In the interest of time, I think let's talk a little bit about epidemiology and talk a little bit about how the incidence of AFRS differs by region and why, if it does, what do you think are the important factors that determine the incidence and the differences in different areas of our country?
So I'm going to throw some crazy numbers at you. And for our listeners, I'm sharing these with a grain of salt in that because of issues with the diagnostic criteria that we've mentioned and others, there just aren't great representative studies, even within the US, let alone internationally. But some rates that are generally accepted among patients with CRS, we see less than 10% meet diagnostic criteria for AFRS. However, if you look in other subtropical regions, India is a great highlight. They have larger case studies and population-based studies in geographic regions within India that report an incidence of up to 79% of their patients with CRS meet AFRS diagnostic criteria. I do not think the Indian population has a eightfold higher prevalence of this disease than other parts of the world. But I think there is potentially something there to look into. The common thread seems to be the atmosphere, the high humidity conditions that favor fungal growth and potentially overgrowth. So your higher rates of exposure in these areas.
Yeah, it's sort of like The Last of Us, right? I mean...
Yes.
Started in India. Yeah, so that is really interesting. So that it's probably not eight times, but it may be higher. And
that's fair.
Certainly we know that if you're treating sinus patients in Boston or Maine, you're gonna see less AFRS than if you treat them in Alabama or Texas or some of these other regions.
Yeah, I completely agree.
So I'm going to jump ahead a little bit and have you talk a little bit about overlapping conditions. And specifically, the two conditions I wanted to talk about is first asthma and then briefly invasive fungal. So talk a little bit about fungal sensitivity with asthma. What are the conditions? How are they treated? And do you think there's an association between those fungal sensitivity induced asthma conditions and AFRS.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think there's a lot to learn from these conditions. Interestingly, it's the lower rate of asthma in allergic fungal that just doesn't make sense. So when looking at the lower airway fungal hypersensitivity conditions, you know, the poster child is allergic bronchopulmonary mycosis. What I learned is ABPA, aspergillosis. We've since learned that aspergillus, although a very common cause of both allergic fungal sinusitis and ABPA, it's not the only causal fungal element. So they now call it mycosis. It is, in all intents and purposes, the pulmonary correlate to allergic fungal sinusitis. These are patients with very difficult to control asthma, with thick eosinophilic concretions that develop within the alveolar air spaces in the lung. Treatment is challenging. They tend to recur, and this is seen as much more of a chronic disease. The other condition, which is really defined by severe asthma with fungal sensitization not meeting criteria for ABPA or ABPM, is really defined by poor identification of the fungus that's driving it, and likewise, extremely high IgE. So again, it looks a lot like the pulmonary version of allergic fungal sinusitis. Treatment is very, very similar, with one important exception, and that is in these lower airway conditions, they at times utilize antifungals. It's not first-line therapy. That is to clear the concretions from the lungs, to decrease that inflammatory load, either through bronchoscopy or with corticosteroids, trying to control that inflammatory process. Very much similar to how we approach allergic fungal sinusitis. The question of biologics is really important for AFRS. And within the lower airway, with these fungal-driven hypersensitivity reactions or conditions, it's only limited to case reports. The best evidence I saw was with omalizumab. But again, few patients improved, but not enough to lead to an FDA indication, for example. So more research is needed there.
So Josh, the rates of asthma are lower in AFRS as compared to the classic Th2-mediated chronic sinusitis. So would you say that these are sort of similar entities in different parts of the airway, but not necessarily related? And when I say this, I mean, Th2-mediated chronic sinusitis with nasal polyps, we know in the unified airway theory are they're related in the patient, in the sense that 50% roughly of patients who have chronic sinusitis with nasal polyps have asthma. Mm-hmm. Would you say that these are like two? So in other words, AFRS does not cause these like AB, allergic bronchopulmonary mycosis. They're sort of related conditions, but not necessarily interactive, I guess is the way I would say it.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. And this leads to a lot of confusion because it doesn't make sense. I appreciate you mentioning unified airway. You know, the pro-inflammatory nature, the upper airway disease and allergic fungal sinusitis should be enough to aggravate and trigger at least some form of hypersensitivity in the lungs. Now, I would have expected a higher rate of asthma in AFRS patients. What is just now emerging, and is by no means the answer, but it may be, is that the lower airway reacts differently to certain mediators than the upper airway. One of those mediators is prostaglandin E2. This is the mediator that pathognomonically is underexpressed in aspirin-exacerbated respiratory disease. They actually have mouse models where you knock out PGE2 synthase and the mice start reacting to aspirin. So it's understood it is an inflammatory mediator in the upper airway, but in the lower airway, it's protective, it's anti-inflammatory. So perhaps, and there's some data now that has just recently been published, actually shows that this same gene, the PGE2 receptor, is one of the most overexpressed genes in allergic fungal sinusitis. And just a highlight of this meeting, I did not make that connection until presenting this research, and one of our pulmonologists who was there said, holy crap, you realize that that is a drug that we explore to help with asthma, and it's clearly a protective inflammatory mediator, anti-inflammatory mediator, specifically in the lung.
So I guess separate entities, but similar, but not maybe as well linked as the classic TH2 mediated diseases.
Agree. It gets murky when you look at the details. Mm-hmm.
I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but I think people get confused with AFRS and invasive fungal sinusitis.
Yeah.
Give me your 1 minute take on related, unrelated, is it AFRS causal? We know that there's underlying conditions that have to be in place for IFS to take place. So
my 1 minute answer is that crazy people get sick too, meaning patients with AFRS can become immunocompromised separate from the AFRS and develop invasive disease. There are case reports showing the exact same with fungal balls. So there is an association in that there are several publications now that have reported patients with AFRS developing invasive disease, but by no means do we see a causal relationship.
Right. So maybe these are patients who are, and I'm just curious, maybe you don't know the answer to this, but when a patient's going to undergo chemotherapy, let's say for a bone marrow transplant, are they screened to see if they have any potential of AFRS or chronic sinusitis or a fungal ball prior to their treatment to make sure that this couldn't progress?
Yeah, I think that likely is going to vary based on the referring oncologist. But I certainly was very pleased to take care of these incidentally identified sinus conditions just with the goal of preventing an issue once they're immunocompromised.
Yeah. Okay, so let's move on to treatment. And let's start with, before we talk about surgery, let's talk a little bit about the sort of medication and specifically biologics. What, in your mind, what are the gold standards in medical therapy for AFRS, and then talk a little bit about the role of biologics.
You bet. So we'll talk about surgery later, but I want to make the point at the top that this is a surgical disease. You know, you have to clear the inflammatory nidus to prevent an immediate recurrence. Treatment from a medical perspective really relies heavily on corticosteroids, both oral steroids as well as topical rinses with mometasone or budesonide. This is a patient that I counsel are likely going to be rinsing the rest of their lives, whereas most others, I present the rinses as a tool that can be used as needed. I mentioned antifungals as an area that are not commonly used or recommended for AFRS. There's actually a Cochrane systematic review that looked at the evidence a few years back and were unable to make recommendations because of a lack of evidence. There's concern that topical antifungals could disrupt olfaction, and just more studies are needed to really understand the cost-benefit ratio there. The other piece is immunotherapy. And again, a lot of confusing information and not clear evidence recommending either for or against. You know, in my practice, I've been absolutely blessed to work closely with immunologists and allergists. And we would find the rhythm where we would test these patients as part of their appropriate workup. And if we found the fungal antigen that they're responding to, we would try and desensitize them. But I have not been able to identify that those patients ultimately do better than those that don't receive the immunotherapy.
And then really quick, Josh, just to highlight a point, is there any situation where you would use biologics and not surgery for these patients?
No, no, I would not.
And then is there any role at this point for biologics in these patients?
Yeah. You know, we had a great panel at COSM just a week or two ago about this. And even on the panel, there's disagreement, which is a good thing. You know, the indication for biologics with nasal polyps is just that, nasal polyps. AFRS is clearly a form of nasal polyps and oftentimes can fit under that umbrella, especially for insurance approval rationale. But the truth is, allergic fungal patients were excluded from the pivotal trials for every approved biologic that's on the market for nasal polyps. We just don't have the evidence to truly know if there's a great benefit, if there's a higher risk of, and this is being hyperbolic, but perhaps by modulating the immune system, there's a higher risk of this becoming invasive. We don't know. And that's a question I want answered to feel better about routinely prescribing for these patients.
That's almost a segue into our next section, but I'm going to, which is our last section to talk about research. But before we finish this section, you mentioned it's a surgical disease, which is the way we're taught. But one quick additional question about surgery. In what cases do you operate on the contralateral side? In other words, let's say that it's a predominantly unilateral disease when you see this patient. Do you always operate on the contralateral side? Do you sometimes? How do you make that decision?
There are some advocates that have even published thought that we should operate on the contralateral unaffected side. So picture, you know, one side has clear disease and the other clearly doesn't. In my practice, I ethically haven't been able to rationalize that, knowing that not every patient is going to develop it bilaterally, and knowing that even though I'm a darn good sinus surgery, there will be complications, and I couldn't defend why I opened an unaffected sphenoid. So my approach is I take a close, hard look at mucosal thickening, any rationale to justify opening a sinus contralaterally, but if it's not there, I don't. And I follow these patients, and if disease pops up months or years later, we'll take care of it then.
Okay, good approach. So to sort of finish off our discussion, I want to ask you about, and this was a big part of your paper, sort of ongoing and future research. So can you talk a little bit about what, to your knowledge, are the most important ongoing clinical or research studies? And then as a next question, what trials do you think are the most important trials, research trials, that we can enact going forward to better understand AFRS?
So starting clinically, there is a study that has completed enrollment, and I'm hoping that we see the results this fall. It was a Liberty trial sponsored by Sanofi and Regeneron. Amber Luong, I believe, was the principal investigator, certainly the leader of the study. And it randomized AFRS patients to dupilumab versus placebo, again, looking for evidence and really replicating those phase three trials just with an AFRS cohort. I think it's critical, and I'm really looking forward to seeing what I expect to be positive findings. But I do not know. I don't have insight into that data. From the more translational point of view, the EP2 study that I mentioned is a part of my lab's work. And while we found a significantly increased expression of the EP2 gene and the receptor itself, the protein, we don't yet know the activity. So perhaps we could think of it as a biomarker. Perhaps it could be a drug target. But first, we have to know, is it active or not? So still, I would say early days on that piece. There's other work, again, from Amber's group, who's really a powerhouse in AFRS, but identified a decreased expression of antimicrobial peptides, particularly those related to fungal clearance. So that certainly could directly explain part of the pathogenesis of the disease. Again, could be a therapeutic target. Can we rinse with, you know, exogenous antimicrobial peptides to help clear or prevent the inflammatory response that's going on? And then the third, the final piece that I think is really important actually started 10 to 15 years ago. Sarah Wise, as junior faculty, was in the lab, and she discovered, again, 10, 15 years ahead of its time, but that there's a significantly decreased epithelial barrier in patients with allergic fungal sinusitis, something that we see in other forms of nasal polyps, we see in asthma. And she did a really exquisite job of defining specific mediators of tight junctions that are either lessened or some pro-leaky tight junctions that are overexpressed. So three, what I hope to be therapeutic targets and options for treatment in the future.
And to sort of the cherry on the top, if you could pick one study that needs to be done, what would it be?
Oof, you're going to hold me to one.
Yep, one study.
I would love to see a thorough evaluation of antifungals to understand the risk-benefit ratio as a treatment that we know has benefit in the lower airway correlates of this disease and potentially could help these patients long-term. But since you're holding me to one study, as part of that, I'm also drawing blood and measuring IgE to see if we can really define that threshold value to improve our diagnosis.
You cheated a little bit, but
I cheated big time.
Well, Josh, thank you so much for taking a little time out from your family and this evening to talk to me a little bit about a really interesting paper that I think provides us who are taking care of this disease some guidelines going forward as to how to understand it, how to treat it, and sort of what we can see on the horizon.
I appreciate it, Doug. You know, we all rise together. And my goal for this is that it helps one patient. And, you know, with time, we'll be able to really implement and improve the care that we can offer.
So to wrap up, I want to just thank our Scope It Out listeners. This is Doug Ray for Scope It Out, the official podcast of the International Forum of Allergy and Rhinology, signing off for now. Take care and have a great day.